Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Spencer Caron. On April 22, 2021, the Supreme Court decided Jones v. Mississippi. The issue was whether the Eighth Amendment requires the sentencing authority to make a finding that a juvenile is permanently incorrigible before imposing a sentence of life without parole. In a 6-3 opinion authored by Justice Kavanaugh, the court affirmed the ruling of the Supreme Court of Mississippi, holding, quote, "The Eighth Amendment does not require a finding that a juvenile is permanently incorrigible before imposing a sentence of life without parole," unquote. Justice Thomas filed an opinion concurring in the judgment. Justice Sotomayor filed a dissenting opinion in which Justices Breyer and Kagan joined. Mark Levin, Chief Policy Counsel for the Council on Criminal Justice and Senior Advisor of Right on Crime, joins us today to discuss this case and its implications.
Let me just kind of start with a summary here. As those of you know, many of you know, of course, Brett Jones was incarcerated or still is incarcerated in Mississippi, and he murdered his grandfather and was, I think, about 10 or 15 years ago, been incarcerated. And then following the Miller and Montgomery decisions, which we'll talk about, he was given a rehearing regarding his life without parole sentence. And the court determined that sentence should stand. The court did consider the youthful factors, but it did not apply a requirement that the individual be permanently incorrigible or, you know, corruptible beyond any hope and corrupted beyond any hope. And that this case hinged on that. And it was a 6-3 decision. Written by Justice Kavanaugh, which held that the permanently incorrigible requirement is not required by the Constitution. And I think that into some of the specifics here, but I think the kind of most important overarching one is, consideration is kind of what we always face in looking at decisions that have policy implications, which is it's important to distinguish between what the Constitution requires versus what is good from a what prudentially makes good sense from a policy perspective. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the legislation that has passed in different states and is being considered in legislative sessions now regarding second look reviews for those convicted as juveniles. You know, I think that there's some, I think members of the general public who just kind of followed the Supreme Court very casually just kind of get the impression that because the Supreme Court said you can have this, that somehow means it's a good idea. And I don't think that was what was communicated in the majority opinion or even the concurring opinion by Justice Thomas. But rather what we get into is really the decision doesn't hinge on juvenile justice. It hinges on your conception of kind of at bottom, right, the by cruel and unusual punishment and whether that ought to be, that definition is kind of more fixed going back to the time of our founding, what was considered cruel and unusual then, or whether it, how much we apply this evolving standards of decency, which is, you know, I think the framework that certainly isn't challenged in the majority opinion, but I think for those who believe in judicial restraint, there's a real concern that if that keeps kind of expanding, where does the line get drawn between what judges who are not elected say is cruel and unusual, as opposed to what's left for elected policymakers to describe and to discern. And I think that's really the overriding argument that comes through Justice Kavanaugh's majority opinion. Going back to, and then, you know, kind of beneath the kind of big picture disagreement in terms of judicial philosophy over how to interpret the cruel and unusual punishment prohibition is kind of then this difference of how you apply the Montgomery decision to the current case. And Certainly Justice Thomas says in his concurrence, and he would go a bit farther than the majority and essentially overrule Montgomery. And Justice Thomas essentially says, well, the majority takes a strained reading of Montgomery to try to make it just a procedural ruling. And what the majority should really do is and just focus on Miller. And to give you all who haven't looked at Miller and Montgomery a while, those who may be on the call, essentially what Miller said was, first of all, you can't have mandatory juvenile life without parole. If you're going to have it, it has to be discretionary rather than required by a state statute for capital murder. But then Montgomery came along, and Miller also said you have to consider the youthful factors in making the discretionary. The judge or the jury, whoever gives the sentence, has to consider kind of the hallmark features of youth, which, you know, of course, immaturity, impulse control, things like that, that are relevant to the culpability in the offense. And then secondarily, of course, relevant to the capacity for change. And then of course, you had the Montgomery case come along, which held that Miller is retroactive. And then that's where you get into, the typical line that if it's a substantive change in the law, it is retroactive. And if it's merely process, then it isn't. And so kind of what happened in this case is, I would say the majority opinion, without overruling Montgomery, kind of winds this back to being a procedural, more of a procedural question. And obviously the dissent rejects that and would carry Montgomery forward or even expand it. And Justice Thomas would expressly overrule Montgomery. So that's kind of where things landed. And I think, as is the case often with Supreme Court decisions, to some degree, I think the country's kind of already moving on. There have been opinion polls which show, a strong majority of people support some type of second look for juveniles. And these bills are advancing in many states. In Ohio, late last year, Governor DeWine signed a provision which, after 18 years, a youth is eligible for parole who would have otherwise had to serve life if for non-homicide, and after 25 years for in the case of homicide. The Maryland legislature passed a similar second look bill. It was vetoed by Governor Hogan, and then the legislature overrode him. And here, where I'm talking to you from in Texas, the Texas House passed a second look bill with over 100 votes a few weeks ago and is now being considered in the state Senate. So it's still about half and half as far as what states have enacted second look laws. But some states are actually going beyond even youths now. In Washington state, they passed one that goes up to 20. And of course, the broader question is being asked of whether, you should even have life without parole for adults. And groups like the Sentencing Project have an initiative to eliminate that. So I think, one of the things that strikes me is, just as it's very difficult to put contours on cruel and unusual punishment, it's extremely difficult to say whether somebody's permanently incorrigible. I'm reminded of the work of the economist Friedrich Hayek, who kind of emphasized the diffusion of knowledge and the fact that in basically defending capitalism, said, that you can't have state control because there's all these uncertainties and only knowledge diffuse among individuals can really produce the innovation to drive society forward. Well, none of us know, of course, whether somebody's going to recidivate. None of us have a crystal ball at the time somebody's sentenced, whether they are, that's 100% sure that they're never going to change. And many of us kind of view this from a standpoint of whether you're religious or not, that of course all people are capable of redemption. Now, there's certainly good arguments to be made about, whether parole boards or courts, how well equipped they are. I will say certainly there have been advances in terms of actuarial assessments that many parole boards, virtually all of them now, use, and they do look at a variety of factors, including someone's behavior while they're incarcerated. Certainly age is a major factor. If somebody's been in prison for 20 or 30 years, they're often not the same person that they were. And I think one of the other things is when you look at a lot of the facts of these cases, you find that they may have been ones in which the young person was involved in a gang, and perhaps they joined a gang for protection. They felt that given the kind of situation where they grew up, often without a father, in a very dangerous area, that they needed to do that. And again, it's not to excuse anything, but you had many of these crimes would involve kind of a turf war between two gangs. And when you take someone out of that setting, and hopefully, you know, again, there's a lot of problems with our correctional environments, but they've been in a totally different setting for 20 years. I think that that's kind of why you see the recidivism data that you do. The study that came out of the Philadelphia juvenile lifers, there was a 1% recidivism rate, and none of them were violent felonies. In Michigan so far, none of those who have been resentenced have recidivated. So again, these are all factors that are ones that policymakers are focusing on. And in the court here was, you know, certainly in the view of the majority, including Justice Thomas and his concurrence, are very much focused on what does the Constitution prohibit versus what does it leave from a judicial restraint perspective to the wisdom of really the public, but you know, channeled through their elected representatives to decide. So I guess going forward, I kind of see this decision as important in the sense that it's going to probably encourage energies of those who want to see further changes, particularly in states that haven't adopted a second look provision. It's going to encourage folks to focus on state capitals, on talking to legislators, certainly more, you know, additional academic research, although I think the recidivism data is fairly clear from what we see already. You know, there are those who certainly believe, regardless of the recidivism data, that somebody who did such a heinous crime that they ought to, for the sake of punishment alone, you know, spend the rest of their life in prison. And you know, that view is not I think it's a minority view, perhaps even among those of us on the right, but it does exist, and I can certainly respect that view. But I think from my experience, a majority of legislators and policymakers, you know, are willing to look at the data and say, does this make sense, if nothing else, from a taxpayer perspective, to pay, you know, $30,000-$40,000 a year to keep this person in prison, you know, beyond, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, when evidence suggests they're a good risk to be rehabilitated. One of the things I've noticed in being part of some hearings on this legislation is that the parents of many of these juveniles who have received life sentences are very active in terms of advocating for legislation. As are, you know, victims are very involved, as they should be, in the process, and some support and some don't. But one thing I noticed is, you know, of course, when typically the parents that are at these hearings, you know, they're in their 60s or 70s. And if, you know, the individual is released after 20 years, right, their parent is there to help them reintegrate. Maybe they're 50 years old and they can get a job, or 45 years old, whatever it might be. Whereas if somebody's released when they're already 65 or whatnot, I mean, first of all, the average lifespan of people in prison is much lower. So it can end up dying in prison, of course. But beyond that, if they're released once they're 60, 65, 70 years old, it's going to be very hard for them to become self-sufficient, and there's not going to be a support system for them. And of course, you know, just from an employment perspective, of course, you've seen, you know, juvenile lifers come out, they don't know what a cell phone or an email or email messages or text messages are. So when such a huge amount of time goes by, it does make reentry more difficult. So one of the things that's kind of been new is there's some nonprofits like the Epicenter Initiative here in Texas that set up to assist with some of those challenges. And there's Louisiana Parole Project. So I think one thing everybody can kind of agree on, regardless of your legal or policy stance on this, is that for those that are released, it's really important to, to take every measure possible to make it more likely they'll be successful, both from a public safety and a reintegration standpoint. So, you know, obviously I have my own views on this from a policy perspective, but on the other hand, I think that there's, from a legal perspective, this decision reflects that it's a very difficult question, and it's one that I think raises serious concerns about, you know, what how far courts should go versus the role of elected officials. And obviously, we saw where different justices fell on that. And I do think the implication of this will be that both, not just within the juvenile context, but I think this type of divide on the court, where clearly there's a majority on a more restraint-oriented approach, I think it's going to cause advocates of positions on both sides of the policy debate to really focus on, other avenues rather than litigation to, you know, resolve these concerns.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.